Stories of Women in the Bible, Class Number 4, Mary Chandler. Other Women's Stories, Sarah and Hagar, Leah and Rachel, Jephthah's daughter, Bathsheba, Rizpah, and Ruth. Now, the task is to do this in an hour. What I'd like to do today is to spend about the first half hour, maybe 35 minutes, going through these fairly rapidly and just giving you a little bit of background on their stories. Then I want to break you into groups like yesterday, but we won't be just doing, all of us doing one story. I'll break you into different groups. So we have six different chewings going on at the same time and give each group one question regarding either the two women together or the individual woman. So I'm going to go fairly fast. You know, if you really need a point of clarification, I will stop at the end of each person, but it has to be a quick point. Tomorrow I'm doing the New Testament, which is why I'm pushing a little bit today. So we'll only be doing four women tomorrow to finish that out. So, all right. I'll start with Sarah and Hagar and Leah and Rachel. These are rather big clumps of stories to chew. You can see up there, if you can figure out what's connected to what, that there are a great many references to the matriarchs. The patriarchal and matriarchal narratives are primarily in the latter part of Genesis, starting with chapter 11, and they are worth just sitting down sometime and reading. They are what is called the start of the historical in the Bible. Not history and non-history or history and myth, but history as understood by historians and archaeologists basically means that there are written records going back to the time of Abraham. So Abraham is historical in that there are written records of the various cities he was in and archaeological digs and things like that, which can serve as a cross-referencing to the times of Abraham. So there's some sort of an external way to test out and explore what is within the Bible. All right, I'm just going to talk through Sarah and Hagar really fast. I think some of the minor figures like Rizpah, whom I had forgotten and did not remember yesterday when I went rushing off to my cottage, are very interesting and worth talking about too. All right, the story goes that Abram's father, Terah, takes Abram and Sarah from Ur to Haran. Ur is at the base of the Mesopotamian Fertile Crescent. Ur is up north in the land around Assyria, and then, of course, eventually he goes over to Canaan. I keep switching because I'm looking at the map for myself, where the movement is like this, but you guys, it would be exactly the opposite, so you're going to have to make your own designations there. All right, Abram, and one of the complications in the stories in Genesis is that there are several different traditions. The Yahwistic story, the Elohistic tradition, and the priestly tradition, and then in Deuteronomy, the Deuteronomic tradition. And each one has its own theology, its own time of composition, its own time of being arranged, and then probably in the 6th century BC, the priestly writers arranged all of it in exile. So you get the priestly account of creation as chapter 1. So you have all of these layers, and the fascinating thing for us, which I think really grates, because we want the one true story, is that frequently there are double stories in here, with different emphases, different plots, different tellings of the story. And so sometimes you'll get one story told twice, and you might think, well, gosh, why did Abraham get the covenant twice? But it might very well have been, it is two different traditions reflecting on an understanding of covenant. Or Sarah getting palmed off twice as his sister might very well have been one story told from two different traditions. And so their understanding of truth, which is possibly very helpful for us as we deal with inclusive language and gender and many images of God, was, wow, they're both really neat, let's have both of them. So toss them in and mix them up. And okay, the first call of Abram is in chapter 12 of Genesis. He gets the call to go from Haran to Canaan. He is promised a covenant with Yahweh, promised both land and descendants. Then in this chapter, he also goes into Egypt, where he passes Sarah off as his sister, and she's taken into the Pharaoh's court until he discovers through a series of plagues what has happened and lets her go. Genesis 16, you have the Yahwistic account of Sarah and Hagar, where she's getting old. She finally gives him her maidservant Hagar to bear children. This was very customary, by the way. It was not an unusual thing at all. Monogamy was not practiced then. That's a very, very late development. In this particular account, Hagar gets very haughty and starts lording it or ladying it over Sarah as she becomes more favored in Abraham's eyes and Sarah stays barren. So because of Sarah's plea, Abraham banishes her in this account. And here she hears a voice from Yahweh telling her to go back, that she will bear a child, Ishmael, who will have many descendants and who will be the father of a great nation. In Genesis 17, you have the priestly account of the covenant where Abram's name is changed to Abraham, where circumcision, which was a very big thing for the priestly writers, is instituted as the sign, and where the promise, the specific promise is given that Sarai, whose name is later changed to Sarah, will conceive. Then there's the apparition at Mamre, the next, the following year, where three guests come and there is a prediction that Sarah will bear a child. Abraham laughs in front of the tent, and she laughs in back of the tent, and she's the one who is confronted with her incredulous laughter. Genesis 20, Abraham passes her off again as his sister. Genesis 21, Isaac is finally born, and Hagar and Ishmael are dismissed. This is the Elohistic account of the dismissal. And here, through a dream, she's sitting under a tree after she has just put her young son under another bush to die. She can't stand to be next to him as he dies, and she can't protect him. When the dream comes that she will be a great nation through Ishmael. Genesis 22 is the one I think we most think of with this tale, the sacrifice of Isaac. And it's really worth wrestling with. I've gone through several metamorphoses in my own life as I have read that story and come at it from all sorts of different angles at different times of my life, trying to struggle with, was the call authentic? Would Yahweh ever ask that? What's the point of the whole story? Would Sarah have undertaken a different reaction? What does that mean for us now? And you know, a lot of other kinds of issues. And I have probably entered that story in any one of a number of ways, depending on different times of my life, and done a great deal of thinking about what would have happened if Sarah had been there rather than Abraham, or Sarah with Abraham. And it's all conjecture, but it's a rather interesting little way to enter that story. So that's about it. They continue to be wanderers. When Sarah dies, she does not even have a place to be buried, and Abraham has to negotiate with some people to get a place to bury her. So even at the end of his life, they are still wanderers. Are there any quick questions about any of that? I just sort of wanted to toss these things out and get moving. I know in one way I'm sort of overwhelming you, but I prefer, since we've had a couple of days to get really intensively into a couple of stories, that I'd rather just give you some more that you can think about on your own. Okay, Leah and Rachel, they are daughters of Laban, who is the brother of Jacob's mother, so they are basically then first cousins. Jacob goes back there to seek out a spouse. He discovers Rachel at the well, falls in love with her. Laban discovers that they're relatives, and it's set up that Jacob will work for 7 years in order to get Rachel. Of course, she has an older sister, Leah, who evidently isn't quite so attractive and has not yet been married off. And so as the story goes, Jacob somehow mistakes the two, and Laban passes Leah off as the bride that night. And so he is tricked into that and contracts to stay another 7 years in order to get Rachel. But then the two seem to enter into a contest to see how many can bear more sons to Jacob. And Leah comes forth immediately with Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, and then throws her maid in for Gad and Asher, and then gets back to Issachar and Zebulun, missing once and having Dinah, But so she's way ahead on that count. Rachel gets off to a slower start, and so her maid Bilhah comes up with Dan and Naphtali, and finally she gets going and has Joseph, and then finally later, Benoni, otherwise known as Benjamin, and it's rather interesting. Benoni means son of my sorrow, and according to the story, she dies right after childbirth when she discovers that this is a male child. She dies and names him Benoni. And the father comes back and names this child Ben-Yamin, or Benjamin, which means son of my right hand. And so he is a favored child through all of that time, and the youngest. Then they make the decision to leave Laban. And Jacob is quite a trickster. He's quite a character. I wouldn't mind having him as a distant ancestor. I'm not sure I would like him as a husband or father or a son even. But so he manages to get more than his share by manipulating the animals so that they end up bearing striped and spotted offspring, which he gets to keep. And that, you know, the genetic understanding there is a little bit weak. And he also steals the household gods of Rachel and Leah's father, Laban. And Laban gets very upset. I think we get so much into monotheism as something that happened so early and was so pure that we tend to put our own concerns back there. It was more what was called henotheism, actually. There's the woman in here who explained exegesis to me this morning. Okay. She had a wonderful definition of exegesis, which I'd never heard before. Is it all right if I tell her? She said she'd never heard it before. It came up to Holden and kept hearing it. And at first she thought, exegesis, it had something to do with telling new and wonderful things about Jesus. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Henotheism. Here's another. I'm afraid to ask anyone what they think that might
be. Well, you...
be a good feminist term. He's not a god.
Heck with this other. No. Well, we know it has something to do with God. Heno means favored, rather than mono, which means one. And really, right? What Heno means favored or favored, rather not just exclusive. And really, all the way down through the temple, through the destruction of the temple, down to the time of Jesus, archaeologists have found all of these little household gods scattered all over the land of Israel. They could date to all times, all the way down. So we tend to think that monotheism finally won out at some time in our distant past, and then it just stayed. But constantly, it's coming back and coming back. And people tended to have their own little gods and goddesses actually in their houses and images of those. And so we have to remember that Abraham, I am your God. The other gods are not important. That sense of I am now your tribal God and I am the one who's going to give you power. The other ones don't have power over you and your family, rather than our interpretation at that time that there's only one God. That's a really long time coming in development of Old Testament history. So they take the household gods as they're making the break, and the understanding then is that they, by doing that, they take Laban's power away. That's where he gets his authority for the clan and for the family. And so they steal them, which is, a tremendously audacious kind of act. You don't mess around with that. And so the way they hide it is just delightful. One of them who is menstruating and therefore unclean at that time and sitting at one part of the tent hides them in whatever she is. This is before Kotex and all this kind of stuff. So she's, in fact, wasn't there something in the reading this morning about an unclean menstrual rag? I noticed that. Well, anyway, she's sitting over there probably on some sort of a camel hide. This was way before tampons. And the gods are hidden under there. And so, of course, no self-respecting male would go anywhere near her. So this is where the gods are hiding and of course, being polluted during this whole kind of session. But it's a very odd story that is sort of hard to quite figure out how to relate to all of that. So then they finally get back to the border of Canaan, and he has to make up with Esau, of course, whom he had tricked out of his inheritance. And so they finally make up. But very odd stories. They come out as bold and daring women and somewhat disobedient in terms of breaking away from their father. Very creative, brassy. That they probably wouldn't fit into many women's circles. It's like there's something about that. There's going back 4,000 years, they're just delightful. You know, we can't really understand them in some ways because it was such a different society, but it really is intriguing to get back into that life and also to realize that somehow it's still created to our faith life. I mean, that's the odd thing. It's not like we can go back and say, God, these people were weird or different or strange or what archaic customs, because as people of the Word, you know, we trace our faith back to them, so we can't even make this disjunction. We somehow have to figure out some way to connect their lives with ours in a way that you would not do if you were just a historian or a literary person. Any quick questions about them? I don't consider myself an expert in patriarchal times, but they certainly are intriguing. And these stories were carried on for generations, by the way, before they were written down, up to 1,500, 2,000 years. Can you imagine carrying a family story that long? You know, I often ask people, and I don't know the answer myself, what is the maiden name of even your grandmother? Do you know that? How many do? Not bad. Let's go great-grandparents. Anyone want to take a shot at that? Yeah. Okay, one. Well, that's not bad. Okay. Jephthah's daughter in Judges chapter 11. Jephthah of Gilead was a son of a harlot. He was exiled by Gilead's legal wives' sons. He became a bandit chieftain. The Ammonites then threatened, this is the time of the judges, before the kings, and he is called upon by the Gileadites to fight the Ammonites for them. And so he enters into a bargain with them, and he says to them, you know, unilaterally on his own, if you deliver the Ammonites into my hands, he says to God finally, then the first person to meet me from the door of my house when I return in triumph from fighting the Ammonites shall belong to Yahweh, and I will offer him up as a holocaust. Now, some of the interesting things in this story is that he wasn't just doing that as a religious kind of thing. He agreed with the Gileadites. First, he was exiled in shame, and then he, in verse 8, chapter 11, he tells them that he does not want to just be a temporary leader, you know, a war chieftain, that they would rise up in times of crisis and then go back to whatever they had done. But that he says that they agree that you may be for us head of all the inhabitants of Gilead. So he's using that vow in order to establish himself not only as being able to come back, but to come back as a permanent leader in the tribe. Neither Yahweh nor the people have required this vow. It's something that he thinks up to get the job and to bring himself back in glory and reestablish himself permanently. And then, rather interestingly, when he goes out and conquers and then comes back and discovers his daughter coming out to meet him with timbrel and dancing, which is a fairly common way to greet warriors. We had that with Miriam when she crossed over with the people. He looks at her and he says, you have brought me low. I mean, you know, it's real interesting. You know, he enters the vow by himself. He tries to use it to aggrandize himself and to come back as a leader of the people. And then when the daughter comes out to greet him, he blames her. You know, you have brought me low. I'm going to now have to kill you and it's your fault. You know, fascinating. Even more fascinating is that she agrees with him and realizes that his vow is sacred, and the only favor she asks is that she is allowed to go off for 2 months with other young women and mourn her virginity. Then she comes back and she is killed at her father's hand. Now, I read some of the Interpreter's Bible stuff on this, and it's fascinating. One of them says, though Jephthah's vow was a thoughtless one, I think it was rather well thought out myself, as he realized too late, he was under sacred obligation to carry it out. And although it cost him, I love that, a daughter, he was under sacred obligation to carry it out, Interpreter's Bible. Also, it talks about Jephthah's devotion and courage and the power and dignity of an indomitable will. And the daughter is commended for her noble submission. And in Hebrews 11:32, he is pointed out as a wonderful hero and model of faith. If you want to go to that, it's rather fascinating little aside here. Is there any need to say more? There is not time for me to give an account of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, or of David, Samuel, and the prophets. These were men who through faith conquered kingdoms, did what is right, and earned the promises. They could keep a lion's mouth shut, put out blazing fires, and emerge unscathed from battle. They were weak people who were given strength to be brave in war and drive back foreign invaders. And then it goes on and on. Well, anyway, it's rather interesting. You know, who paid the cost of Jephthah's success and way back into the kingdom. Okay, Bathsheba. I think most of us know a lot about her, but basically, when we hear that word, what do we think of? How do we feel when we hear the word Bathsheba? What kind of an image comes to our mind?
Elizabeth Taylor.
Okay.
What?
Susan Hayward.
How did Jephthah kill his daughter?
Well, some claim, later interpreters, that he, of course, just promised her to perpetual virginity, yeah. Well, actually, the way he did it was probably burning her as a Holocaust. I mean, that's what Holocaust means. So
yeah,
it's probably that she was slaughtered and then burned completely. So, Ah, Father Love. I like that henotheism. Okay. Okay. What about Bathsheba? How do we usually image her?
Taking a bath.
Taking a bath, but in terms of how we feel about her as a
seductress.
Seductress.
Yeah.
Sensuous, tempter,
bordered.
Desperate, not so okay, desperate. You know, there are overtones when we hear of her that somehow she is a temptress, seducer, adulterer. It's very interesting because when you get back and read all of those texts, you know, a lot of people, okay, what happened evidently was this is the time when David is consolidating his kingdom. She's living in Jerusalem because her husband is a mercenary who is a leader fighting the enemies of the Israelites. I don't know how many of you have been to Jerusalem, but it's a very strange, odd city, which it hasn't changed terribly, at least inside the city walls. I mean, the city walls have migrated north, and I haven't quite figured out how they did that, but in terms of these ancient buildings, it's like houses on top of houses, and they tend to live on the roofs of the houses. There aren't things like lawns or you know, picket fences or anything, and so they live outside wherever they can, and so you'll see kids playing soccer three stories up, for instance, or people out there cooking and visiting with one another, and so when you're up high, you actually can look down over the city and see literally dozens of people's personal lives when they're living outside. And so it's not like she decided she was going to move to a place where the king could see her. She's probably just, in fact, she's taking a bath. You know, they didn't have inside plumbing there. And as the story goes, it's quite possible it was the cleansing bath following menstruation, because it's pointed out that she had just been unclean. And there's what's called a mikvah. There's a ritual bath at the end of that period of uncleanness that women had to go through. So she wasn't just lounging around, you know, getting a suntan on her way to the coast for the weekend. You know, we have to sort of, you know, think about the time. And so she
Mary,
is...
Mary, I think the operative phrase would have to be, she must have asked for it.
Yes, that is usually the way, that's usually the way it's interpreted. So he summons her, and then the next thing is, even if you get through the first part, that she's just seen accidentally rather than, you know, showing her stuff. Some people say, well, couldn't she have said no? You know, as if, you know, well, you know, of course we have perfect rights over ourselves and our sexuality. And, well, no. You know, I mean, that wasn't even an option then. You know, that they didn't have that kind of power and autonomy. That's a fairly recent thing for us. And so when he wanted to have intercourse with her, she virtually could do nothing other than possibly kill herself. You know, she, you know, couldn't report to the local headquarters of NOW, you know, in the downtown streets of Jerusalem, or file some sort of a suit through the sexual harassment suit, you know. And so we have to realize that she did not we don't know what she felt about it, but in terms of her choices, she really had none. So he gets her pregnant, and then the whole story goes that Uriah, she tells him, and then Uriah is summoned back, and David tries to set it up so that he sleeps with his wife, so he thinks that this child is his. But because he is so loyal to David, and because it was considered an impurity in a time of war, he doesn't even do that. And so here the king is sleeping with Uriah's wife and a few other people too, while Uriah, the mercenary, is being faithful to David, even to the point of not even having sex with his own wife. And so then Uriah is set up so that Uriah gets killed. And then it is whose son who dies as a result of David's sin. And it's very interesting. You know, it's David's firstborn son by Bathsheba. But it's, you know, it's like, and it's very clear that it's David's sin. You know, Bathsheba is not called a sinner in all this. It was David who was violating, what, another man's property, basically. You know, that was the story Nathan told, the parable of the ewe lamb raised in the family, and then the ewe lamb is taken. So it's rather, and then eventually her second-born son through David Solomon becomes the next king, but rather interesting story. Now, Rizpah and Ruth, I want to get into really quickly. Rizpah, who mentioned her, by the way, yesterday?
Somebody. I did.
Oh, okay. I had totally forgotten that story. I mean, I'd heard it at one time, but had dropped out of my own consciousness. It's a terribly bitter, heart-rending story, and it doesn't even take up that much in the scriptures, if you can read through me or around me. Rizpah was a concubine of Saul. When Saul and Jonathan were killed in battle, she was to go to the next person, Ishbosheth. But Abner, who was Saul's uncle, decided he liked her better. But even then, as a concubine, she was just considered part of the harem to be handed on to whoever had the right over all of these women and their children. And so finally, Abner defects to David's side because Saul's forces and David's forces were still struggling over who was going to lead. Then David gets into hot water very rapidly, both in terms of the intrigues of all of his various sons by his various concubines and wives who are struggling to take over after he dies, but also outside of that, there are a lot of different tribes that were not Israelite that were struggling with him. And so he's having particular trouble with the Gideonites, and Yahweh informs David that the reason for this is that Saul had been very unfair to them and had offended them deeply. And the only way to cause them to make peace with him is to go to them and say, all right, what do I need to do to make peace with you? So David goes to the Gideonites and asks them this question. And their response is, we want seven of Saul's sons to execute as a way to end this. So he gives them five of Saul's grandsons and then the two sons of Rizpah as a propitiatory sacrifice, and then they are executed. And so the story goes on that Rizpah then takes sackcloth, goes out to where her two sons had been put on the ground. They were not even buried. They were used as a public shame. And she stays there from the beginning of the barley harvest, which is early spring, all the way up to the fall rains. And she covers them when it rains. She keeps the birds of prey and the animals of prey away from their bodies. She was not allowed to bury them. And then finally, about 6 months later, David, hearing of her fidelity, goes out to collect the bones of those seven plus Saul's and Jonathan's to give them proper burial. So just picture that, you know, her long vigil there over her son's bodies through 6 months worth of rains and animals and try to figure out what that would have felt like. Then Ruth, I don't want to get a great deal into Ruth. There's a whole bunch of discussion about when this book was written. Some people think it was written during the time of the United Kingdom under David. Others as late as the 4th century. I myself prefer the 4th century BC version. It is more of a parable, and it has to do with exclusion and inclusion. The Jews at that time were closing down and saying salvation is only for the Jews. There are no outside marriages. They had just rebuilt the temple. People like Ezra and Nehemiah were becoming more and more ingrown in terms of the understanding of salvation just for them and the laws just for them, and trying to break up marriages with outsiders. You know, you can read the book of Ezra and Nehemiah in regards to that. And just even in terms of the characters, now just think how much coincidence this was, would be. Ruth's father-in-law is called Elimelech, my God is king. You know, that's not too bad. Naomi is called the fair one. Orpah, the one who turns back, you know, the other daughter-in-law, the word actually means the one who turns away. The two sons who die are named Mahlon and Chilion, one meaning sickness and one meaning pining away. Now, I mean, how many people would, you know, name your sons that? And then Ruth means the beloved. So, you know, in some way, they're sort of stock characters to play out this drama of fidelity and infidelity. And as you know, they go from Bethlehem of Judah, which is David's city. They have to go back to Moab because of the famine. There Elimelech dies and the two sons marry Ruth and Orpah. Then all the males die, and then they have to go back to Bethlehem because they've heard the famine is over. So they go back, and they are somehow trying to make it on their own, two women, Naomi and Ruth, by going after the gatherers. They were not supposed to pick up, you know, what is the word I'm looking for?
Gleaners.
Good. I knew it started with a G. I was just, okay. They could not pick up things that fell. That was for the poor. And we have that in the New Testament, you know, that food is for the poor. So she and Naomi were following after picking this up and discovered that Boaz is the Goel. This is where we get the word redeemer. It comes from the word Ga'al, to redeem. They don't write it this way, they write it this way. And his responsibility was to have care for all of the people in his extended family. And so they discover that Boaz is the Goel for them. And as the story goes on, he is unmarried, she is very beautiful. And finally, what does Naomi suggest to her to do? Do you remember that?
Go lie
in the field. Well, go lie in, I guess he was probably in a threshing barn or something, but to go when he is asleep, go there after he is asleep and lie down at his feet until he wakes up. Now many people think that actually was, you know, not just, you know, brotherly, sisterly kind of thing, but interpreters differ on that. But it was actually throwing herself on his mercy and trying to make herself as attractive as possible to have him marry her so that she and her mother-in-law can have protection. And so, of course, he finally does do that. But to just sort of think of the way that they had to do that in order to be protected. Are there any questions about any of these? I want to go back now and break into six groups and have you have one question apiece that I want you to wrestle with and then report to the larger group. Let's see, we have, actually, I want to have seven groups because I want to do Sarah and Hagar slightly differently. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 32, 36, okay, 7 and 2, 36, okay. Groups of about five, okay? The question I want to ask, now if you have a special favorite, I guess you could tell me and get in that group. Do you really mind or if you have a strong bonding with Mizpah, for instance, I would let you talk about her. okay, why don't the first group, you five down here, the question I want you to ask yourselves, if you or Sarah, and if you could have been secretly present when Abraham was offering his son, what would your thoughts and feelings be? Okay. Now, Hagar, about four or five of you back there, Hagar, as you have been banished and you're placing your baby under a faraway bush because you can't stand to watch him die in your arms, what are your thoughts about the Hebrew God and about Abraham and Sarah? Okay, got that? Now, Leah and Rachel, this should be a sort of interesting one. You guys, okay, you can move, you know, I'm gonna give you about 10 minutes to wrestle with this. Leah and Rachel. You want a group of Leah and Rachel back there? Okay, the two of you have decided to be audacious and help your shared husband, Jacob, by deciding to steal your father's household gods. How do you feel about taking such an active part in your escape and changing allegiances from your father to your husband? Now, who's going to be that? About four of you back there. Okay. Jephthah's daughter. You want to do Jephthah's daughter up there? Okay. Your question is, what are you thinking and feeling? Can you keep it down until I give them, I'm almost done. What are your feelings as you spent your 2 months in the mountain with your young women friends as you head back to your father to be sacrificed? Okay. Now, we have Bathsheba, Rizpah, and Ruth left. Do you want to do Bathsheba up there? Okay, Bathsheba then is, your son has to die for David's sin. How do you feel about that? Okay, we have Rizpah left and Ruth left. Rizpah, as David is approaching you after you're being there for 6 months, what are your feelings about David knowing that he had to preserve his kingdom by sacrificing your two sons? Gosh, that was informative. You're number two?
No, I think the first reaction was,
if my husband were to be son of my daughter, I'd go after him. Uh-huh. Now that way, and then...
Sounds good to me.
But then that also means that you, as a woman, be widowed, and then you get tell your story.
Well, to me, it's like God intervened to create, this is part of how he created the new relationship with Israel, whereas the Canaanite cult practice was to sacrifice the firstborn in order to assure fertility for your crops and your animals. As the Israelites came into Canaan, they brought some Egyptian practices with them and they picked up some Canaanite practices, and this was where God was entering into their relationship to say, you know, this is a unique relationship. You don't have to go to continue these practices of these other groups, and you don't have to kill your firstborn son. And as for Sarah, I saw a very interesting play last year where, at the moment where Abraham raises the knife, it's she who comes in as the angel to say, don't do it.
Okay. We had one other comment here about, you know, Hagar and, you know, sending your slave, you know, Hagar and role, that it's come around again because now we're having people be surrogate mothers to their children.
Yeah. Okay, Hagar, where are you? Back there? Okay, as you place your baby under a distant bush to die, what are your thoughts about the Hebrew God and of Abraham and Sarah?
Almost indescribable.
Try.
I was wondering whether God had promised her anything about her son before he sent her out into the desert.
Well, in this story, she thinks he's going to die, and then only after that feeling.
Well, went back and checked an earlier verse, and Yahweh had said to her that her son would become a wild ass of a man against every man against him, setting himself to defy all his brothers. That was the only promise that God had made to her about her son. So, the only thing she could have been mad at that God for was that he had promised her that he would grow up.
Right. A little minor detail, yes. A wild ass of a baby who is. Yeah. Any other thoughts from that group?
Well, I think the question is how religious was she? She may have put him under a bush and said, well, God, what now?
Yeah. Pretty hard place to be. I hope I never have to be there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, a lot of us get there.
Yeah. Most of us, however, I think, get there metaphorically rather than actually. I hate to have to actually think of an actual real child of mine in that position.
It's
very heavy. Yeah.
You know, the story of Abraham, his son, has a lot more meaning since I have a son. Mm-hmm. And I cannot read that story
That's
to my
right.
son without crying.
Yeah.
I think, well, yeah, I think when you talk about Jimmy's Corner upstairs, you know, you talk about the Howie and Betty Olson, whose daughter had a freak accident and they had the, you know, where it was doing a cold of lungs or not. And, all those decisions, it sounds like the same kind of thing. Sure, if this Jimmy's Corner is a new one, Jimmy also.
Oh, I didn't mind that. But I think we even have trouble with things where, say, some of the issues around subsistence and how we're going to lead our lives, where we think, well, but if I do that, I'm not going to have the money for my child to get the best college. I mean, that the level of our sacrifices
yes.
for our religion are somewhat less in magnitude than we're talking about here. I think these stories do have power to the extent that you really say is, I mean, there's something in this story that says God is even more important to you than your own offspring. I mean, that's just a remarkable notion to us, I think.
Okay, I think Rachel and Leah had the hardest one, but hey, I didn't choose them. As the two of you decide to be audacious and help your shared husband, Jacob, to steal your father's household gods, how do you feel about taking such an active part in your own escape and going from one tradition to another?
I think that we thought they were justified doing what they did, that their father was not really very good to them, or he was not very good to Jake. So that it was time for them, they weren't that sad about turning their backs on their father. It was time for them to move on.
And the funny thing is, you know, Jacob was such an audacious person himself, but they did it without his knowledge, and he didn't even know about it. So it's like, you know, they almost outdid him in Jacobing, you know, out-Jacobing
yeah.
Jacob there. I'm not even sure if he would have dared to do something like that. So it is interesting. Okay, Jephthah's daughter, you are coming back after 2 months knowing that you're going back to your father who is going to kill you to fulfill his vow. Where's Jephthah's daughter up there? Early version of Father Knows Best.
He was, she's the daughter of this big mouth, Archie Bunker, who's drunk and falling off a bar stool and says what he says, and then he's going to be upheld in this kind of hope. It's just a real test of faith. We examined the options, the practical options. She could keep going. We'd like, you know, trying to be her first person singer, we'd like to keep going, but then where are we going to go? The society doesn't allow it. Where are you going to go? And probably, when it comes down to it, she's going to feel, well, these are the rules of the game. And as you said, Father knows best. God knows best. We're just really impressed by the difference between how we do things today and how it was then. And several of us volunteered to go out and start an hour chapter.
Sounds good.
You know, you can be pious and say, "Thy will be done." But boy, that's the hardest thing. We didn't. I don't know if we succeeded in doing it. I would feel bad.
Well, that's good. I think that's a good way to be in this story. I just was feeling angry most of yesterday afternoon. Okay, Bathsheba. Your son has to die for David's sin. How do you feel? Where's Bathsheba? Are you up there? Okay.
We had one question. Did she know why the child died?
She knew that what he had done was wrong, and she had no control over it, so... She knew it was David's sin, though, but it was her son. So, I mean, from her point of view. So.
Well, we felt, you know, that she was probably having feelings of guilt, you know, even though she didn't have any control over what David had done. Being heartbroken, having carried, you know, the child for 9 months and, you know, caring for it. So how old was the child?
I think he's just a young baby. I don't know if it says.
She would, you know, of course, be sad, you know, feeling anguish.
Yeah. Plus, having lost her husband over two, huh? Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, Rispa.
Did you have any feelings about any of this? We haven't had any insight into how she feels.
It has quite a bit about how David went on and on.
That's
and
right.
On. The child didn't just die right away.
It doesn't say anything except that she was summoned and she told him she was pregnant, and that's about it. And then later on, there's some court intrigues when she and Nathan team up to make sure Solomon becomes the king, but that's much later in her life, so.
What about the tradition that her uncle set her up because they wanted to be get power with David?
You mean in terms of the first baby? Well, I don't think that's biblical. I mean, you know, and she was... you know, obviously an outsider from the Israelite tradition anyway, so she wasn't within that inner circle. Rizpah, how do you feel after being there for 6 months watching your son's bodies rot and David finally comes 6 months later to give them an honorable burial?
Can we ask that? Why did it take him 6 months to figure out
that? Yeah. Word travels slowly.
It wasn't his favorite concubine, but one of his, and I thought, wow,
yeah.
Slow. The other thing that one of the ladies said was, this story is obviously not meant to have anything to do with Rizpah. It's all David.
That's
and
right.
David. And it just in one sentence says, she went out at harvest time and
put her sackcloth on the rock.
And put her sackcloth on the rock and had them to swap animals
yeah.
all day. And that's it.
That's right.
The whole story.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Get that gesture now.
To show David that's only there to show
It's there and set and boy, David after 6 months figured out the wristband was gone.
Well, that was when she came up on his rotation schedule. Who knows?
I didn't hear